This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 12, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, we'll take a look at the Karl Rove papers, some 5,000 pages of documents revealing that Rove had a direct hand in the firing of U.S. attorneys. Students with disabilities face high rates of violent punishment in U.S. schools.
The problem is corporal punishment is ultimately ineffective. It may stop the child's behavior for a short period of time, but it doesn't teach the child why what they did was wrong and how they can behave better.
And the movement grows to release political prisoners in Haiti. Many of them remain in jail without charges.
We have petitions to President René Préval to free the political prisoners. People shouldn't be in jail because of their political beliefs.
All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today in Honduras, pro-Zelaya supporters were once again in the streets of the country's largest cities. Yesterday, thousands entered Tegucigalpa as the National March of Popular Resistance against the coup reached the capital after 6 days of walking from the interior. What began as a peaceful march to the Honduran capital ended in violence and repression as demonstrators began to call it a day. FSRN's Tim Russo is on the ground in Tegucigalpa.
Protesters hoped to end their march at Tegucigalpa's Pedagogical University, but riot police and the military forced them to turn back. Violence broke out after an urban bus nearly ran over people in the crowd. One person was shot as the police tried to intervene, and protesters set the bus and a local fast food restaurant ablaze. Approximately 40 people were detained and many were treated for injuries. In the aftermath, the de facto government announced a curfew for the capital. Francisco was one protester who managed to make it into the university. He and others spoke to a crowd of about 300 people, all the while trying to protect themselves from a shower of tear gas, rubber bullets, and stones from the police outside.
Si quieren capturar a unos, nos vamos a ir todos.
Todos.
Cierto.
Todos. Cierto, cierto.
If they come to capture one of us, then they have to take all of us. Nobody gets taken alone. We'll all go. We are going to defend ourselves, but if they surround us, there's nothing that we can do. Here in this parking lot, we'll surrender, but we'll have human rights observers and international press here with us to guarantee that things stay under control.
Vamos a tener la prensa aquí con nosotros y vamos a garantizar que no haya desorden.
Today, the March for Dignity made its way through the capital once again. Ousted President Manuel Zelaya is due to arrive in Brazil for talks, and the Organization of American States is expected to soon announce a date for its new mission to Honduras. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tegucigalpa.
The conflict in Yemen continues to escalate as Sunni-led government troops stepped up their fighting against Shia Muslim Houthi based along the Saudi Arabian border. The conflict has ebbed and flowed over the past 5 years. Today, the Yemeni government bombed rebels based in a northern town, leaving dozens dead. But there is no clear picture of how many civilians were killed in the attack. Today is the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Geneva Conventions, a series of four treaties that govern international warfare. The treaties were negotiated and updated by the international community following the atrocities of World War II. They established rules for the treatment of prisoners of war, the wounded, and civilians. 194 nations have ratified the conventions. International Committee of the Red Cross spokesperson Anna Nelson says the conventions don't actually set out to end war, but instead seek to make the practice less barbarous.
We've seen some progress in recent years in terms of the violations that we see no longer really going passing in silence or going unnoticed. We've seen that increasingly those responsible are being held accountable for their actions, and that's a good sign.
Despite the international support, critics argue that in many cases the conventions are not upheld or enforced. Civilian deaths are commonplace in conflicts, the most recent examples being the wars in Gaza, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Republic of Georgia. In the past few years, the U.S. has been cited by critics for violating the conventions through the alleged torture of detainees in Iraq and Guantanamo. Red Cross President Jacob Kellenberger denounces disrespect for the conventions.
There remain far too many violations. But I would simply like to say it would be quite a wrong impression if one were to think that the violations are the rule and the respect of the law is the exception.
Critics also say the Geneva Conventions are not suited to the current realities of war, where militant groups are not easily distinguishable from civilians. ICRC says international humanitarian law, quote, must continue to evolve to respond to the changing nature of armed conflict. In the latest of a series of environmental protests throughout Appalachia, activists gathered at the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection in the Capitol Tuesday. Four people chained themselves to the building's doors and were forcibly removed and arrested by police. Reporting for FSRN from Charleston, Erica Peterson of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
This protest was the 12th this year organized by environmental groups seeking to end mountaintop removal mining. Four activists chained themselves to the door of the DEP building, demanding that the state relinquish control of several programs to the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. The protesters argued that the Department of Environmental Protection has been incompetent in regulating mining in West Virginia. Richard Bradford joined other activists at the protest and was wearing a custom-made t-shirt that said, West Virginia DEP sucks.
I think the DEP is doing wrong, and I think they've always done wrong. I think they're taking up for the coal company, and they're rubber stamping these permits for the coal company, and they don't care about the private individual, and I think they should be done away with.
Authorities have released the four activists on bail. Protesters say there have been 90 people arrested for civil disobedience so far this year at mining-related protests. Erica Peterson, FSRN, Charleston.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
A congressional investigation released more than 5,000 pages of documents and testimony of former Bush advisors Karl Rove and Harriet Miers on the controversial firings of U.S. attorneys. The documents reveal that politics played an important part in the firing of one of the U.S. attorneys and that Karl Rove was instrumental in the decision. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Until now, top Bush advisor and political operative Karl Rove has escaped any solid connection to the firings of nine U.S. attorneys for alleged political reasons. But 5,000 pages of emails from the White House and the Republican National Committee reveal that Rove had a direct hand in the firing of U.S. Attorney David Iglesias of New Mexico. Emails reveal that as early as June of 2005, Iglesias was targeted by Rove's staffer in the Office of Political Affairs as someone who needs to be fired because of his, quote, lack of action on voter fraud. Rove was not only included on emails discussing the need to remove Iglesias, but he okayed it. Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine.
Karl Rove, immediately after his last interview, came out and told everyone that he had only a minor role. And now, of course, we see the release of the transcripts and documents, and as almost everyone expected, they show exactly the opposite. They show that Karl Rove is right in the middle of the entire process.
The email chain reveals extensive conversations that Iglesias was not doing enough to help Republicans in the 2006 election. One email to Rove said Iglesias has, quote, failed miserably in his duty to prosecute voter fraud. And another email says the Republican candidates are, quote, getting killed out there. Representative Heather Wilson was one of several Republican candidates in tough re-election races. Republican Senator Pete Domenici pushed Rove to fire Iglesias. These documents shed new light on the long-running scandal over the alleged firings of nine U.S. attorneys. Again, Scott Horton.
Well, remember, the president was entitled, and the attorney general as well, they were entitled to dismiss these U.S. attorneys for any reason or for no reason, but not for an improper reason.
Critics say that a U.S. attorney that advances party politics is indeed improper. Melanie Sloan is Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
It is critical for all Americans to have faith that the Department of Justice is running criminal investigations because people are involved in criminal wrongdoing. It can't be for political reasons.
The documents reveal that politics and elections were central, that Karl Rove was directly involved, and that once the story became known to the press, the White House struggled to craft an adequate message. This is the most extensive information released thus far. The Department of Justice Inspector General finished its own investigation last year, but both Karl Rove and Harriet Miers refused to cooperate. And this is the first time the internal emails have been released. The Judiciary Committee will hand over this information to federal prosecutor Nora Danahy, who will decide whether to press criminal charges. Scott Horton says even U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez could be implicated.
And in these documents, we see, you know, very clear evidence that Alberto Gonzalez, in all the things he was doing, was taking instructions straight from the White House. In fact, it was Harriet Myers, Karl Rove, and their staff who were driving this entire process.
The first email of thousands of documented pages regarding Iglesias was sent by Timothy Griffin in the Office of Political Affairs. He later became interim attorney general in Arkansas after Bud Cummings was removed. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Also in Congress, a commission on wartime contracting wrapped up 2 days of hearings examining the spending practices of top government contractors that provide translators for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Commissioners pressed these corporations' executives to explain how they used billions of government dollars in light of reports that administrative salaries were rising as salaries for translators were being cut. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
As military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan have progressed since 2001, the need for military translators has increased. And as government spending for translation services has increased, so too has competition among intelligence corporations to receive government contracts. Pratap Chatterjee, author and managing editor of corporate watchdog group CorpWatch, says the rapid growth in the need for translators has created problems.
The United States employs upwards of 10,000 translators in Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay today. And this is something that has, grown, expanded considerably over the last 7 years, starting in 2001. Originally, they had one tiny little contract for a company called BTG to provide, a dozen or so translators in Kuwait. Now, this is over 10,000 people. The military needs a lot of translators. And so they say, we'll take as many as you can get, because they themselves, as they've admitted in this testimony, had no expertise. Nobody at INSCOM, the Intelligence and Security Command, speaks Arabic or Dari or Pashto. So they relied heavily on these translators, these companies like Titan and L3, to bring in the translators.
In 2006, a company called Global Linguist Solutions, or GLS, took over the government linguist contract for $4.6 billion and has been the primary contractor ever since. They have retained L3, the previous contractor, as a subcontractor for the hiring and development of translators in Iraq and Afghanistan. The two corporations are at the center of the Wartime Commission's investigation this week. With so much government money going towards GLS, the commissioners on Wednesday pried for answers to questions regarding waste, incompetence, and in some cases, minor fraud.
This contract and the taxpayer became a cash cow, sort of a great big juicy steak that two companies were cutting thick slabs out of, this cash cow. Poor taxpayer.
That was Charles Tiefer, one of the commissioners and a professor of law at the University of Baltimore. He and the other seven members of the commission grilled the executives from GLS and L3 for explanations on certain expenditures in the face of salary cuts for translators.
$5 million in spending that was overspent because of private housing for vendor management and administrative personnel, private three-bedroom apartments for individual employees, an isolated instance of a contractor with deployed dependents at government expense, automobile densities of a 1-to-1 ratio for management personnel, lost productivity due to less than expedient transit of linguists into Iraq. Is that where your experience got us?
Some observers say that GLS could provide translators for the war efforts without subcontracting L3 and others. In 2006 and 2007, L3 protested the rewarding of the contract to GLS on three separate occasions, eventually getting a $1 billion subcontract from GLS as a concession. The GLS executive says they would not have rewarded L3 with a subcontract if they had not protested on multiple occasions. Still, Tom Miller, representing L3 at the hearing, said the company provides much-needed expertise to the staffing of translators in the Middle East.
By becoming a part of the GLS team, we became a part of their management. We grafted onto them our experience, our lessons learned, our abilities. And then we didn't stop at that. We literally handed over proprietary intellectual property because that was the best thing for the contract. You're looking for an altruistic sort of action on the part of an American corporation, there it is right there, because we had a greater concern about the performance of this contract. We wanted it to go very well.
The commission will release a report this year based on its findings from these hearings and research. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In some 20 states across the U.S., educators are physically abusing students with disabilities. That's according to a new report from Human Rights Watch and the ACLU. About 30 states have banned corporal punishment, which often includes paddling a student with a wooden board. But researchers found that teachers and school administrators often go further and beat, slap, pinch, and drag students. We're on the line now with Alice Farmer. She authored the ACLU Human Rights Watch report. Thanks for joining us, Alice Farmer.
Thanks so much.
You interviewed dozens of parents and students for this report. Could you tell us about some of their stories?
Sure. We found that corporal punishment is used in many places in the U.S. and that it's used frequently against students with disabilities. And some of the families we spoke with told us instances where students with disabilities were paddled, and that's taking a long wooden board and swinging it against the child's buttocks as many as 3 to 10 times. And it can happen for minor misbehavior, like being late to class, or it can happen for bigger transgressions like violence. But one of the things that really troubled us was that with students, some students with disabilities, they're also getting paddled because of conduct related to that disability. So an autistic child might be rocking back and forth, which is, you know, fairly common for autistic children, and yet they'd be paddled for that.
For the states that allow corporal punishment, is there a legal definition of what teachers can do and cannot do?
Well, corporal punishment is legal. Paddling is legal in 20 states in the U.S. There are some limits state by state. So usually the use of excessive force is considered impermissible, but it's very hard to define exactly what excessive means. And in our research, we found that parents who've tried to pursue cases in court to defend their children's rights have had a hard time meeting the standard of excessive force.
So what sort of legal recourse did the parents have if they felt their child was being abused?
Parents have very little legal recourse in states that allow corporal punishment. Most states that allow corporal punishment also have immunity laws protecting the educator from civil or criminal prosecution for assault. Some parents describe that they've had trouble once their child's been injured. They go to the school board or to the superintendent and yet meet resistance in when they're trying to secure better discipline for their child.
What have been the effects of these corporal punishments, the slapping or using this wooden board, on the children with disabilities?
We saw that after corporal punishment happened to students, that their disabilities their conditions would be become worse. So, for instance, we saw that with students with who were on the autism spectrum, that their parents reported that their children became withdrawn, or that their autistic behaviors became more pronounced after receiving corporal punishment, that they became fearful of returning to school, that they became aggressive and self-injurious themselves. So, you know, this is a real problem.
Your report found that teachers and school administrators are using corporal punishment on students with disabilities at higher rates than at students without disabilities. Why is that?
Well, we're not sure precisely, but we do know from data collected by the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education, we know that corporal punishment is used at higher rates against students with disabilities. And in Tennessee, for example, it's used at more than twice the rate against students with disabilities as it is against the general population. One of the problems we do have as well is we think these numbers are generally undercounting the rates of corporal punishment, because some of the violent discipline of students that falls outside of the definition of paddling, such as pinching or slapping young children or throwing children into walls or floors or grabbing them with enough force to bruise, many instances like that are just not recorded at all. So even the numbers we have, we think, undercount the issue.
Are teachers or administrators trained on how to use these corporal punishment techniques?
No, in general, there's very little training around this issue. That that teachers don't tend to be trained in how to paddle. I had a superintendent tell me that that's just the kind of thing you know how to do. So they're not trained in how hard to administer the punishment or when to administer the punishment. The other, there's a problem with training around effective ways of dealing with students with disabilities. These are students who really do need excellent educational care, and yet we're finding that teachers and paraprofessionals lack the resources they need to deal with it.
Now, in these 20 states that permit corporal punishment, what arguments are used to support the continuation of this practice?
Well, some school officials do argue that corporal punishment is cheap, and corporal punishment has been used for many years, so why change now? And those answers just aren't really, they don't really address the problem. The problem is corporal punishment is ultimately ineffective. It may stop the child's behavior for a short period of time, but it doesn't teach the child why what they did was wrong and how they can behave better.
That was Alice Farmer, the author of Impairing Education, a study that investigates how disabled students are affected by corporal punishment at public schools. In Mexico, the Supreme Court overturned the sentences of 22 people who were jailed for the massacre of 45 indigenous Mexicans. The Actial massacre occurred in December 1997 when a group of paramilitaries who also came from local indigenous communities attacked a group of men, women, and children, some of whom belonged to the pacifist group Las Abejas. 18 children died in the massacre, and more than 80 people were incarcerated for the crimes. But defense lawyers recently asked Mexico's Supreme Court to overturn the sentences of more than 40 of the alleged criminals, arguing that their cases had not received due process. In a divided vote, Mexico's Supreme Court said that irregularities committed by Mexican prosecutors who handled the case, such as including false evidence and administrative errors, justified reverting the sentences of 22 prisoners. The cases of 35 more prisoners are under review. Some human rights organizations are opposing the Supreme Court's decision. Victor Hugo Lopez works for the Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center in Chiapas.
We are worried about this move by the Supreme Court because the court is only looking out for administrative mistakes here. We also agree that some procedures were violated as these people were investigated, but we think there is more to it. We do not think the Actial massacre resulted from a conflict between rivaling communities. We think the Mexican state is responsible for this crime.
The Fray Bartolomé Center has conducted in-depth research on the Actial massacre and has interviewed witnesses and families of those involved. López says witnesses are certain that those whose sentence may be reverted were involved in the massacre. But he also wants Mexico's Supreme Court to interrogate important figures over their involvement in Actial. López says he thinks the Actial massacre was part of a broader plan to eliminate indigenous resistance movements after the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas in 1994.
We obtained a government document called the 1994 Campaign Plan for Chiapas. In this campaign plan, it says that one of the objectives of the Mexican army is to arm civilian groups in Chiapas so as to douse indigenous resistance and to neutralize all populations that might support autonomy for indigenous peoples.
More than 80 people are in jail charged with participating in the Actial massacre. But the Supreme Court is only considering reverting the sentences of those who didn't plead guilty. Amnesty International is calling for the release of Haitian opposition activist Ronald Dauphin, saying it opposes his continued detention without trial. Dauphin has been in jail for 4 years, and he's a member of the Lavalas Party, led by former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. 5 years have passed since Aristide was removed from power. The democratically elected Aristide was deposed in a coup and flown out of the country in a U.S. government plane. Now exiled in South Africa, Aristide calls it a kidnapping by the United States and its allies France and Canada. Following Aristide's ouster, many members of his Lavalas family party were jailed by the Haitian authorities without a trial and remain in prison today. Judith Scher has the story.
Activists and human rights organizations continue to call on the Haitian government to release political prisoners, including Ronald Dauphin. Pierre Labossière is a founding member of the Bay Area Haiti Action Committee.
We have petitions to President René Préval to free the political prisoners. People shouldn't be in jail because of their political beliefs, because of their strong feelings that President Aristide is the true spokesman for their aspirations. They were put in jail on trumped-up charges, never a day in court, and they are sitting there for years. Those people need to be set free, all of them, not just Ronald Dauphin. It's a shame that President Préval can be presiding over these kinds of conditions in the country.
Paramilitaries arrested Dauphin the day after the February 29, 2004 coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Dauphin was an activist in the Lavalas movement, the political party of exiled President Aristide, and a former security guard for the president. Prison officials said they were holding Dauphin and other Aristide supporters because of their involvement in an alleged massacre. However, a United Nations human rights investigation concluded that the event was not a massacre, but rather a clash between two armed groups. Dauphin's case has never come to trial. Human rights attorney Brian Concannon is the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's working to get Dauphin released from prison.
When the Lavalas government was ousted and President Aristide was kidnapped on a U.S. plane, Lavalas opponents started a wave of revenge against Lavalas supporters. And as part of that, Ronald Dauphin was arrested by a group of insurgents. He was arrested without a warrant, completely illegally.
Dauphin is a former soldier who incurred the anger of the military for his support of Aristide during the 1991 coup. Dauphin became a grassroots activist in the exiled president's Lavalas party, which champions the rights of the poor and improved economic conditions for the masses. Many Lavalas party activists supported the current Haitian president René Préval's 2006 candidacy. They thought he would free political prisoners and bring Aristide home. And Préval did free several implicated in the alleged massacre, including former Prime Minister Ivan Neptune and former Interior Minister Jocelyn Privert. But Dauphin and other less prominent individuals remain behind bars, while Aristide remains in exile. Haitian officials deny there are political prisoners in the country. Haiti's ambassador to the U.S., Raymond Joseph, says he's never heard of Ronald Dauphin.
There are no political prisoners in Haiti. The fact that Neptune and the others are out of jail, and they were the most prominent, and that this person that you're talking about is still in jail, to me underscores what I just told you. Some people are in jail, but not for political reasons. But since they belong to a certain party, they are shopping this around and saying, it's because I belong to this party that I'm in jail.
Despite Joseph's assertions, pressure to free Dauphin is growing. Congresswoman Maxine Waters of Los Angeles recently wrote to Préval and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, calling for Dauphin's release on human rights and medical grounds. He is severely ill with hernia and prostate conditions. Dauphin is detained at the Port-au-Prince National Penitentiary, where 4,000 prisoners are crowded into a facility built for 1,800. Judith Scher, FSRN.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.